Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Michelle Singletary is back with us. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Hello.
25 years? Did I blink and suddenly it was 25 years of you writing your column?
I know. I'd like to joke. I started at the Post when I was 10, because I know people are doing the math. Like, wait a minute.
10, 5, you mean? 5.
Yes. That's even better.
Okay. So for the few people out there who don't know who you are, this is Michelle Singletary, one of our absolute favorite guests of all time. She's come on the show quite often. She is the nationally syndicated columnist at the Washington Post. Her column, The Color of Money, is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And we've got a link to that, by the way, at onpointradio.org. And Michelle is also author of The 21-Day Financial Fast, Your Path to Financial Peace and Freedom, and What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits. So we're going to talk about all the lessons that you've learned over these 25 years. So first of all, let me ask you, though, like, do you think your core beliefs about money and personal finance, have they shifted at all in a quarter century of listening and helping to other people?
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, a lot of the basic information I know about money I gained from my grandmother, Big Mama, who raised me. And she just had basic stuff that kept her going and kept her solvent and just the best money manager I've ever known. And it's, you know, live below your means. Every dollar that you get, you save a little piece of it. You know, hate debt like it was a person and you wanted to just slap it. You know, give back to your community. She, you know, believed to whom much is given, much is required. And, you know, and when you're investing should be boring. I know a lot of everybody is out there, you know, wanting to do speculation and make money really quick, but just, you know, saving and over time you'll get there. And so the basics are the same no matter when you get into this money game.
And apparently, according to your column, she was nothing if not consistent, right? Like every tell us a story about what she told you every time. Every time you got on the phone with her.
Oh my gosh. So I graduated from college, University of Maryland in College Park. And my grandmother said, you need to come live with me, save your money for a year, or years. And I said, sure, absolutely. Love my grandmother, live for her for a year. But she had some things that kind of like bothered me a little bit. Like I didn't have to be to work till 10 in the morning. She would get me up at 6 a.m. so that I wouldn't be late. And my job was 10 minutes from where I lived. So I thought, you know what? I need to be on my own. So I went out and got an apartment without her knowing it. And when I told her, she was livid because she said, you know, why are you giving your money to the white man? And you have to understand the generation that my grandmother came from, and her grandparents were enslaved individuals, and she believed in home ownership. Yeah. And so I rented for just 1 year. And I am not exaggerating, folks. Every single time I called my grandmother, every single time for a year, the first thing she would say to me was, you're still giving your money to the white man. And I just, and at the end of the year, she said, you have two choices. You can come back and live with me, or you can buy some property. And folks, I bought a two-bedroom, one-bath condo so that I wouldn't have to get up at 6 a.m. in the morning or take the shoes from underneath my bed, because my grandmother says if you keep shoes underneath your bed, if you get a man, he's going to run out of your life. And I'm thinking, I don't have a man. I'm just going to get a condo.
Well, listen, you actually said something that leads me to a question I wanted to ask you for quite some time. Because, mm-hmm. You know, the consistent things about finance that you just laid out that haven't changed in those 25 years, like not wanting debt or looking at debt as the devil, in fact, is kind of core to that. And I really want to know about how much that comes from the history of that Black Americans have lived in this country. Because, you know, I do wonder in the Black community, and especially the Black community that you grew up in, Michelle, the sense that to have anything in your life that would impede on your liberty, which debt does, it can do that, would be anathema. Tell me, am I connecting you're, legitimate dots here?
You are connecting the dots exactly right. My grandmother, you know, came through the Great Depression and then the Red Summer when many prosperous African-American communities were burned to the ground because they were doing so well. And so she was so fearful of having anything that would obligate you to white establishment. And so absolutely, I mean, with no debt, you have more choices. Even if she lost her job, which is, you know, and when she was coming up, was a real threat when you were Black. If you didn't have loans, if you paid off your house early, you could make it until you got that next job. And so for her, she's like, don't have those chains of debt. And recognizing, you know, my grandmother borrowed to buy a car. She borrowed to buy her house, but she would make extra payments so that she could get out of that debt as soon as possible and free herself from that obligation so that if something happened to her because of discrimination, because of redlining, because all the things that happened, she would be able to make it to the next, you know, paycheck or next job. And that's what she instilled in me. And I tell you, I've been at the Post 30 years total, 25 for the column. And I still think, oh, they're going to fire me. Oh, they're going to fire me. You know? And of course, they're not, right? You know, but I just, you know, I have that fear still. And so I try to do a great job. I try to, you know, keep my debts down. I try to save so that if anything ever happened, I could live till I got to that next job.
Yeah. So this, I mean, I really appreciate you sharing that with us because you are so passionate about debt. that you even preach about it in church, right?
I do. I belong to First Baptist Church of Glen Arden in Prince George's County in Maryland, and it's a huge church. We have a financial ministry that I run. We have financial classes, and so we're always talking about freeing yourself from debt, particularly high interest credit card debt. And so my pastor asked me to teach a couple, you know, one Sunday. You know, we had four services at a time, so I taught, you know, four services about, you know, the dangers of debt. And we did a little experiment one time in church, and we asked, it was only like maybe about 15 or 1600 people for Bible study. And we asked everybody to write down how much debt they had, not including their mortgage. Uh-huh. And it was astounding at that group. It was millions and millions of consumer debt. And that was just really eye-opening for me. And one of the reasons why I have this year-long ministry at my church to help people free themselves so that they can then use that money to save for retirement or send their kids to college debt-free. Or help relatives, like right now we've got the pandemic, free money in your budget so that you can help other people in your life.
Well, so we have a little bit of you preaching your personal finance ministry at your church. So here is Michelle Singletary talking about mortgages and car loans.
I don't want you to think that I say don't get a mortgage. That's not what I'm saying, because most of us can't afford to get our home without a mortgage. And I'm not even saying don't get a car loan, although you do know that you can pay cash for your car. Do you not know that? They will take cash. They will. Because we shouldn't be getting loans for cars. You could save up for a car. See, I see y'all not getting me on this. I see y'all. But you can. Because here's a trick my grandmother told me, that when you get a car loan, you only get one. Then after you get that one, when you pay that one off, you take the payments that you were paying on that, you pay it to yourself. So then when you need a car in another 10 or 12 years or 15 years, is how long my husband and I keep a car, then you'll have the money for a car. Amen?
Michelle, did they get you after a while?
They, you know, well, I can't say they all did, but but quite a few people did. And in fact, after one service, a woman came up to me. I'll never forget this. My pastor does financial messages all the time. And he was pointing me out in the congregation, and she ran up to me. She says, I just was at the dealership over the weekend and signed up to get a car for $40,000, because she went in to get car repairs. And they said, oh, don't fix this car, get a new car. But she could not afford that payment. And so I said, take that car back. She was in the window at which you could take it back. I said, take it back. I gave her the name of my mechanic. And you know what? The amount of repairs was not nearly as much as the dealer had told her. And she took that $40,000 car back and fixed the car that she had. And it really helped her stay on point with her finances.
Wow. Well, you know, it's funny. Cars are they're a really particular American thing when it comes to like what they mean to people too. But but in my life, I was really lucky with my parents and their approach to personal finance. I mean, I think they spiritually went to the Big Mama's school of savings and personal finance practice, because like as I grew up, we only ever had used cars, and like some of them were very, very, very used, right? Like my dad used to have this giant Chevrolet that you could hear coming from about a quarter mile away. And I remember when he was like, it wasn't until he was like in his mid to late 50s. There was one day we were sitting, just having a picnic, and he turned to me and he like almost whispered. He was like, daughter, I have something shameful to admit to you. And I was like, oh my God, Dad, are you okay? Like, what's going on? And he goes, I have the urge to buy a new car. it was like a major moment in my family's life, because he was just so he still couldn't quite figure out why he wanted a new car when used cars were just fine.
That's right. And, you know, here's the thing which I love about your story, because you can, you know, when you're starting out and you're trying to build your wealth, you know, you buy a used car, because when you buy a new car, the moment you buy it, it depreciates in the first year, anywhere from 20 to 30%, depending on the type of car. And so for most of my life, we had used cars, but then you get to a point where you are well established financially and you can buy that new car and it's okay.
And he did what you recommended. He saved up and paid for it in cash. So
that's right.
Michelle Singletary is with us today. 25 years of her personal finance column, The Color of Money, in the Washington Post. It's quarter century anniversary this year. So we'll talk a lot more about lessons learned about how Americans manage their money. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and the one and only Michelle Singletary is with us, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Her column, The Color of Money, nationally syndicated, is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. So we brought Michelle back to talk about lessons learned about how Americans manage their money and what she's seen, learned, and advised over that quarter century. So, Michelle, hang on here for just a second, because we connected with Lynette Harris, and she told us that she loves credit cards. And when a bank offered her a card with a $1,000 credit limit in college, she was hooked.
I love credit cards. I've always loved credit cards. I think Citibank is my friend. I had credit cards at Lane Bryant. I had them Sears. I had two Citibank cards. I had a Southwest credit card. That was for when I fly on the plane. She's like, why are you flying if you don't have any money? But if you put it on the card, so you get points. And then you get the airlines for free. You see how that's doing? I'm ganking the system. She's like, no, the system is ganking you every time. So yeah, about 15 credit cards. But when we first, that first year, we paid down like 10 of them.
Okay, so the she that Lynette's talking about is you, Michelle. But she also told us that credit card companies, she now believes, are wrong in the way they try to pull in new customers. But Lynette told us that she holds herself responsible as well.
They kind of hooked me. I don't blame them because my mother and father taught me that credit was wrong. I did it anyway. So it's not like I wasn't taught at home. My parents didn't have credit. They bought even their cars. They bought their cars cash. So I had been raised the right way, so to speak. But when I got out there and I thought I knew better, you know, I'm more educated. My parents didn't have a degree. I've had a degree. So people with degrees have credit cards, you know?
That's Lynette Harris. Now, Michelle, the reason why, I mean, we could talk about credit card debt until the cows come home, honestly. But Lynette gets to something there that I want to hear your thoughts on. And that is, money, of course, is security, it's independence, it's freedom, it's comfort, it's knowing that your future, you can protect yourself against uncertainties, all of those basic things. But
it's also
status, right? And money, whether it's actually cash money or credit money, I really sympathize with people who look around the United States and our consumer culture and our status culture. And when Lynette said, you know, I'm in college, I have a degree. People in college have credit cards. Can you talk about that? About that pull? And you know, is it the how powerful is that pull? And is it wrong to feel that way?
You know, it's not wrong because that's how we are conditioned. That marketing machine out there is very powerful. And when we talk about peer pressure, we often talk in terms of children and teens, but adults have an amazing amount of peer pressure to keep up with their neighbors, to keep up with people they graduated, you know, people in their church. And, you know, when you think about it, when I teach, I use commercials a lot as a teaching tool. Like you see the commercials around the holidays, you know, buy that new car, you know, and the car is in the driveway with a big bow. Everybody's like, oh, it's like, no, not all. You know, you can't afford that new car with oftentimes a lease. And so it's really hard to fight that machine to get more, have more. We measure ourselves by what the stuff that we have, stuff that is not going to count when it needs to count. You know, I mean, you buy kids all kinds of stuff, Christmas toys, you know, video games, all that stuff. But then when it comes time to send them to college, we don't have a dollar saved, not a dollar. You know, when it comes time to retire, you're tired. You're ready to retire, but you can't because you spent all those years buying stuff because that's what you were told. You need to upgrade. You know, my husband and I drive used cars, you know, quite a bit. We keep our cars forever. And, you know, one time my nephew, he was joking because I went on the Oprah Winfrey show and he was just like, how you going to go in there? You drive that old car, you know? And then he's like, you're going to get a new outfit. You better get a new outfit for the show. And I said, why? Oprah hasn't seen nothing in my wardrobe. She the one who's the billionaire. You know?
No matter what you wear, she's going to outdress you, too.
Exactly. I mean, I love Oprah, but she hasn't seen anything. You know, I didn't even get my hair done. I did my own hair. You know, so she wasn't going to pay to get my hair done. And you know, that's, I try to live that life to show people that it's not what you have. And I know we're approaching the first half hour, but if I could tell you, my husband and I volunteer in prisons to teach inmates how to handle their money in a reentry program. And I went to teach, and I only have a certain amount of outfits because I just don't buy a lot of clothes. And I went and taught in this pink jacket and this suit and whatever. And I left and I was invited to go on to Meet the Press. And it was the rotation for that suit. So I wore the same suit on Meet the Press. I went back to the prison for a follow-up. And one of the inmates walked up to me and she said, hey, I saw you on Meet the Press. And I noticed you had that same outfit on. Now, in my head, I'm thinking, chick, all you wear is blue. So, you know, are you really trying to, like, embarrass me on this? And so then, and, you know, I was joking, I, you know, you know, I was really mad. And so I'm letting her talk. And then she said, I told you that because when you wore that suit on that program, which is, you know, prestigious program, Meet the Press. And then you came, you know, and you wore that same outfit to teach me, a former drug, you know, user and prostitute. It made me feel special.
Yeah.
It made me feel valued. Mm. And I thought, man, well, first of all, I'm glad I didn't cuss her out. And secondly, she got it, right? She wasn't trying to embarrass me. She was trying to say, you showed me that I don't need to have a whole bunch of stuff to impress anybody.
Yeah. Wow.
And that stuck with me to this day. It stuck with me.
Well, all I have to say to that, the only thing I can add is, we don't care what you wear on the radio.
Which is why I love radio, right?
And also, just this morning, the On Point staff was gently reminding me that I basically wear the same jacket to work every single day. And I got that's it for right. free.
That's right. You know, tell them they don't be asking you about your jacket. That's right. You saved a lot of money.
I tell my kids, hey, what's mama's favorite price? And they say in unison, free. What's mama's second favorite price? On sale. So, yeah, I'm getting them while they're young here, Michelle. Okay. So we want to hear, we reached out to other members of your church because I was really fascinated. We were really fascinated to learn sort of how your finance ministry actually works in the lives of members of your congregation. So this is Trinita McCall and her husband, Will. They live in Clinton, Maryland. And here's Trinita.
I was raised in Southern Maryland in a two-income home, mother and father, both college educated. Never learned about money in that regard. Never sat down with my parents and did a budget. They taught me how to put money in a savings account, how to write a check. Fast forward to becoming an early 20-year-old person, got in credit card debt just like anyone else, but had a good job, was able to pay that off. But I never really understood how to manage money, how to have goals with money, how to save for a house, for example, those type of things.
So here's the thing, just about everyone has a vice of some kind, that one thing that's hard to give up when you've got to make changes to your budget. For Trinita.
Now, my immediate challenge was grocery shopping. The grocery store was like my shopping mall, and I would go to several grocery stores. Like it was my Saturday thing, grocery shopping. And I have every freezer full, every type of anything you could ever want. Every type of spice, seasoning, fresh herb, things I didn't even know what to do with. It was my jam. I was a grocery store aholic. I'm making filet mignon. I'm cooking lobster, scallops. We're eating good. I could easily, in a month, for two people, husband and myself, spend $700 in the grocery store. And when I mentioned that number to Michelle, her jaw dropped. She basically passed out. She's like, I just don't understand. How are you spending that much money in the grocery store? So we are, as a ministry, starting our financial fast today, actually for the next 21 days. And so we were laughing on Saturday as a ministry. I said, so ladies and gentlemen, now is the time that you would eat those 14 cans of garbanzo beans that you bought at Costco in bulk. Now you have to figure out what to do with them. And you don't shop for what you don't need. So that might not sound difficult, but it's no Amazon shopping, because that's shopping too. It's Instacart. It's all of those conveniences that make it not seem like shopping, but it really is. I am in much better financial shape now. I have retirement savings. I have personal savings. I have emergency savings. I don't have as much what we call life happen savings as I would like, because life happened. The pandemic happened. My husband lost his job in the pandemic in 2020. So we've had to make a number of financial adjustments. But what we can say is we survived because of the principles and things that we've learned through this ministry.
That's Trinita McCall in Clinton, Maryland. Now, Michelle, obviously you helped Trinita tremendously. But what's come up again and again
in members of your congregation that we've spoken to is, and actually something that sort of resonates really deeply with me too, is that when you have to make these challenging decisions on where to do that belt tightening, there does come a point where you're like, well, how much is this going to just, this is something I love. It gives my life richness and meaning. Is it really worth cutting it? What do you think about that? Because but Trinita clearly, like, she knows her way around a kitchen and like,
oh yeah, she's a great cook. She puts together some fabulous meals. And at the ministry and when I teach out in the community, one of the sessions that I always teach is getting rid of a sense of entitlement. Because we feel we're entitled to something, a vacation, a certain kind of car, certain kind of house. And oftentimes when you dig deep and ask people about their financial backstories, how they were raised, it circles back to something that happened to them. They were low income or poor and didn't have enough. And now as an adult, they took a vow that they would never have that feeling again. Or this happens a lot, because when I was teaching at the prison, one of the women said, I had everything as a child. And then I couldn't get that same thing because that was my parents' money. So they, went and sold drugs. And so you can overindulge your children and make them bad money managers. We don't want to deny ourselves. And I try to challenge people to say that, yeah, you can enjoy, you can take a vacation, but you don't have to go anywhere. You have to learn how to be okay with being just with yourself, walking around in your neighborhood, going to the community park. You don't have to buy something or go to dinner or do something that costs you money that you can't afford to be okay in your skin. And one of the things my grandmother taught me, she never, never, never apologized for what she couldn't get us. Never. Because she said, that's all I have. And you need to be satisfied with that. Now, at the time, I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't like that. I wanted the sneakers that all the other kids had. But as I became an adult and had to pay my own bills, I'm so appreciative of her telling me that. Because when I didn't have a lot, I was satisfied. And now that I have a lot, I'm satisfied. And I don't need a whole bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I can live whether I have a lot or little.
I'll say it takes.
And that's what I try to teach people.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of mental training, though, to get there. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Now, Michelle, let's get back to the great Lucifer in your life, and that's debt. Whenever debt arises, you come to slay, I have to say. But let me bring in another voice in here, because actually, there are people out there who agree, like, strongly agree with your general line of thinking, but the way debt works in society today and sort of viewing it as an almost universal evil, let's debate that a little bit, okay? So joining us now is Teresa Ghilarducci. She's director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School for Social Research. She's a labor economist and an expert in retirement security as well. Teresa, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, hi, Meghna, and I am so honored to be on this show with Michelle Singletary. I can't tell you.
I am so honored to
well,
have
I'm
you.
A big fan, too, of Teresa, by the way. Huge fan.
Honestly, I'm just here basking in the brilliance of two super smart women when it comes to finance and money. But Teresa, look, the way Michelle looks at debt, I very much sympathize with it, although I do carry some debt myself. But what I constantly wonder about is, look, in this country right now, if you don't have a lot of immediate access to liquidity, which is a lot of Americans, taking on some debt at some time, maybe that, I mean, Michelle puts mortgages aside because you need to have a home. You need a mortgage for a home. But like other forms of it, maybe it's okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I have changed my mind too. I had a credit card balance once when I was in college at Berkeley. The Bank of America gave me a credit card. I thought this was a way I could socially climb. And I had a $50 balance and I couldn't pay it for 1 month. I paid it the next month and I never had it again. So I have the same reaction to debt. I grew up poor, grew up on food stamps, public housing, and a profligate mother. She taught me lessons, but the opposite way. But I have learned over the years, I've taught for 37 years at fancy private schools, the New School and also Notre Dame. And I've learned from my students, from my freshmen, my first year students, and to my PhD students, that borrowing money for certain purposes make a lot of sense. First, it makes a lot of sense what you said, Meghna, to bridge those times when you have an economic shock, to stay in your house, just to make it, keep your standard of living for a couple of months. But it also makes sense actually to leverage. Some households can invest so that the rate of return they get from their investment is more than the interest rate they're paying. That's rare, but it's something that we can't ignore. So I've changed my mind. I've softened a bit over time. I also have a secret life because I wrote a personal finance book myself, and I write for Bloomberg on personal finance. But my colleagues, now I'm outing myself, PhD economists who go to the American Economics Association don't know that. It's my secret life as a personal finance person, because what I've learned from my own household and from my students is that preaching frugality, which I can do that, don't buy this, don't buy that. What I do is induce shame. And what I don't want to do is induce shame. I want to introduce power. And so we all have power as a consumer, as a saver, as a worker, as an investor, and as a voter. Uh-huh. And so I frame my teaching around those four, those five sources of power.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here, Teresa. I'm so sorry. Absolutely. It's killing me that we have to take a break, because I feel like we're, with the two of you, we're on the cusp of something important here. So just hang on for a minute. Teresa Giller-Ducci and Michelle Singletary. We'll talk a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're speaking with Michelle Singletary and Teresa Giller-Ducci. And you know I wish we had 2 to 3 hours to spend with these two brilliant women, but we've only got 17 minutes left. So, Michelle, you heard Teresa there, that sort of empowerment versus shame. I'm going to just let the two of you talk it out here for a minute. I'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, no, I don't necessarily agree with her. And the way I teach, I don't use, I don't try to use, frugality or being a pincher as sort of a sledgehammer, it's very important to do that. But here's what I say. People are looking for a way to co-sign on bad financial decisions, taking on too much debt. And so I am absolute about it because I know I'm way over here. This is my pastor always says, you're like way over there, Michelle. But if I say debt is evil, debt is bad, it's going to make people pause and think. And then maybe they aren't going to be where I am. But if I could get them to the middle, where they're going to buy a house, but they're not going to do what people are doing now and paying 10, 20, 30, 40 overpriced, homes and then get stuck with this mortgage they can't afford. Or this, give my kid a blank check to go to any college that you want and we'll figure out how to pay for it later. Well, that later comes into people's retirement. And, you know, if I say, debt is bad, buy your car with cash, you know, maybe you're going to buy that used car instead of that new $40,000 or $50,000 car you can't afford. And so I need to be that absolute. I need to be that voice that they hear in their head when they're about to go do something that they gut and their bank account knows they can't afford. And so Teresa has a place to say, hey, this is okay if you need to do it this way, but my job, my mission is to get you to hate it so bad that if you have to take it, you're going to use extreme caution.
No, I really like that. What I twisted a little bit to say, hey, you have power, and there are predators out there, and they have marketing tools, and this is the way they get to your dopamine. But they're not worried. Right. They're not. I teach a little bit of neuroscience between dopamine and serotonin. They want you to want. But scientists say that what you want isn't what you like. And what you want is to be satisfied, to like it. That's actually serotonin flooding your brain. And they're goading your dopamine. You buy that handbag, and for 30 seconds, you feel on top of the world, and you get this kind of dopamine hit. You're unsatisfied and you go back again. So I actually teach that kind of dopamine cycle, but I do it in the frame of power. You have the power and insight and knowledge now to one up them. Housing is really tough. I wrote a column to say this is not the time to buy a house. This is the last 2 years because prices are going up. You want to buy a house when prices are going down. You may buy a little bit more, but right now it's a hot market. We could talk about houses and stuff, but the rule is you put 20 to 40% down and you only get a 10 to 15 year mortgage. And that really reins people back in on buying a house. These little tricks we can do to give power as a consumer, to give power as a saver. I just do a little bit of math, the power of compound interest. You know, you have to teach that. That's the math that you need to teach.
Teresa, can I just jump in here quickly? Because hearing you say that you just get a 10 to 15 year mortgage, I was thinking, well, I'd be living in a cardboard box then in the market that I live in.
That's the point. That's actually the point.
Yeah. And here's the thing about housing. We talk about it. And I already told you that I've been a homeowner since 22? So I've never rented other than that 1 year. And so I'm a big believer in home ownership, but it is not the only way to build wealth. And this is what I tell the folks that I teach when I say, get a house that you can afford. Don't, you know, people say, get the house and then the income will catch up. That's crazy. So what I tell them is that, okay, so you get a house, you've got equity built in there. How do you access that equity? There's two ways, really. You got to sell, which then you still need housing, or you're going to use debt. So I've got plenty of equity in my home. I don't even care because the only way I can get to it, short of selling, is to borrow against it. And so you are not a financial failure if you rent, especially in these communities where housing is insane. The cost of housing is insane. Or, you know, do multi-generational housing, you know, live with other folks until you can get to the point where you can live on your own. I mean, we've been sold, I think, a bill of goods when it comes to housing that, you know, this is how you build wealth. Well, okay, this is how you build wealth and then borrow and get into debt, more debt. You know, I want you to get into that house, not worry about the equity, and get it so you can stabilize your housing costs from month to month, year to year, and then use extra money to build for retirement, send your kids to college, and, you know, invest so that you can buy that car in 10 to 15 years with cash.
Yeah. So I'm going to jump in here again because I see it a tiny bit differently, Michelle, when it comes to housing in this country. Okay. So the building wealth thing, as I see it, is perhaps not for the first time homeowner, but that intergenerational wealth that happens when that homeowner's kids get a house that has little to no mortgage left on it, you know, it is, I think, one of the big drivers of intergenerational wealth in this country. And in fact, looping back to what we were saying earlier, Michelle, I mean, I think we know that because home ownership levels in the Black community have been suppressed for all sorts of reasons, it's one of the reasons why there isn't as much intergenerational wealth in Black families.
This is true. Go ahead, Teresa. Go ahead.
No. I feel like I'm having the same conversation I have with my colleague, Derek Hamilton, over lunch and dinner and drinks, because he says exactly what Meghna says. But I see something different because my population are people over 55 who are really figuring out how to live the rest of their life. And they are often house rich and really cash poor because they've been sold a bill of goods that they have, that they want to have some bequest, some legacy for their children. So they build up their house. They're told that they should own their house and they're stuck with this house with a huge maintenance cost. They need money now for all sorts of reasons, you know, pharmacy, and there are no good ways to get it out. And so a lot of people inherit money and it's accidental. A lot of people would like to give money to their kids while they're alive, to their grandkids while they're alive, to help them save on themselves. So we have a really catawampus way of building wealth, and that house can be a huge burden. A lot of people sell their houses at losses. You know, house prices don't always go up. So I'm a big fan of renting under certain circumstances as well.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to jump in here. Sorry, Michelle, because we're just running.
No, that's right.
9 minutes. It's killing me. So I know there's a lot of listeners out there who are like, well, home ownership is just not in the cards for them, period, because they're dealing with something else. Mm-hmm. And I know you've worked with families with young people, Michelle, and of course, Teresa, you're teaching them. So student loan debt. So for example, here is a listener, Kathy, who called us from Hawaii, and she says she finished college. She did finish college, which with $25,000 in student loans, and it took her years to pay it off. But then she also said she doesn't think student loans are an essential for life.
I don't have sympathy for people with student loans. It's like choosing to go on a European vacation, something many people can't and will never be able to experience. If you choose that European vacation versus a staycation, that was your choice. There's always going to be these opportunities to keep up with the Joneses, like what type of car you drive, what type of handbag do you have, what neighborhood do you live in?
Michelle, you go first.
So I'm a little conflicted in how I'm going to answer this, because I agree that people are taking on way too much in student loans, way too much. I mean, it's just crazy. But I do know that there's a population of people without some loans, they wouldn't be able to go to college. And we do know that for the vast majority of the population, entry into a middle class job requires you to have a college degree, although you can make it well and not have a college degree. But for certain, you know, lots and lots of positions, you need it. Where we went wrong is that we said, do it no matter what. You know, we're sending kids off to, you know, private schools or out of state, and half of what you're paying is room and board. To me, that would be like walking in the bank and saying, can I borrow to pay my rent? And so that's the conversation that we need to have. And I do think we do need to still have sympathy for people who have a lot of student loan debt, because just think about it. They're taking it on when they're 18 and 19 years old. What do they know at 18 and 19? I know I didn't know. I know more than most because my grandmother taught me. But, you know, and then the parents see this kid who's done everything that they're supposed to do, trying to make better for themselves, and they get sucked into, well, they did do well, so I've got to take out all these loans. So the conversation we have to have is, say, mostly to the parents, because they're the ones who have to sign off for these larger loans, to say no. They go to community college for 2 years and then transfer to the university. No, you commute. No, we can't afford that. And obviously, there's a conversation right now about student loan forgiveness. And I think there's some people who absolutely deserve it, some people who can afford to pay it back, and some people who are going to have to make extreme life choices to pay back $150,000, $200,000 in student loans. Mm.
Teresa, go ahead.
Oh, no. Hey, policymakers, if you're listening to me and my colleagues at private universities, we've exploited parents and their children way too long. First of all, make student loan dischargeable in bankruptcy. Just change the law. Also, universities, if you take a dollar from students, whether it's loaned or not, you'd be responsible for it. I would want all universities to not be able to have their students be financed on government loans unless we provided like free career counseling. But we've been taking their money. Yes, you can major in art history. You know, borrow $120,000, you'll get a job because it's a college education. The universities have not been responsible for connecting our students with jobs, and we really need to do that. And I've been a big beneficiary of that because I teach at private schools. I pride myself because every year, one or two of my students actually drop out and go to a community college, or they take their first 2 years at a state school. Lots of evidence shows that where you go to school actually doesn't matter that much. You think you make these fancy connections at this private college, but not that one. And it's actually proven to be untrue. We have to make community college cool again. Mm. And we have to make commuting from home, even those first or 2 years, cool again.
Yeah, well,
that's exactly right. I totally, 100% endorse that. You know, I went to Baltimore City Public Schools, went to University of Maryland State School, got to the Washington Post at the same time. A dear colleague who's still my friend, he went to Harvard. We got to the Post at the exact same time in our careers. Both did, you know, we did well in our careers. Right. So you don't have to do that if you can't afford it.
Well, Teresa Ghilarducci, I got to let you go here in a second, but I want to sneak in one last question, because last time we had you on the show, we were talking about this exciting idea that you and a colleague had come up with. And it's not really apropos of this conversation, but I'm dying to know what's happened to it. Now, this was this idea of trying to let the average American save for retirement in the way that federal employees do. Did you make any traction on Capitol Hill?
Michelle and Meghna, this plan I concocted with a top President Trump economic advisor. We kind of came together from, you know, the left, the right, and came together and agree that everybody deserves to save for retirement in a safe and secure manner, just like federal employees do. And I can't announce it, but we have Republicans and Democrats who are about ready to announce it. A bill. And Meghna, and Michelle, you'll be some of the first to know when that bill lands. But the idea is that the government can help people save for their retirement with a refundable tax credit. Right now, all the tax breaks for retirement go to the top 20%, like about 79% of it goes to the top 20% because of it's an income deduction. We want to make a refundable tax credit for everybody in their retirement account, and it'll be managed by professionals, so that you don't get broker calls all the time, that you don't like chase crypto for your 401k. That's just not helpful. Yeah.
Well, Teresa, definitely let us know when that comes through, because I want to have you back on for another hour about that. Teresa Ghilarducci, director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School, and also visiting scholar at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and personal finance columnist for Bloomberg. Thank you so much, Teresa, for coming back.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Michelle, we got 2 minutes left. Oh, God, it's so hard. I keep thinking about Big Mama and quite frankly, the very powerful influence that my parents had on my outlook on personal finance. Because, in their case, as immigrants that came, didn't really have any money. And so scrimping and saving and thinking into the far future about what kind of life they wanted to live has really very powerfully shaped me. And it just makes me wonder. So when you're working with families, the most important teacher to lay down any kind of habits about money are, the elders in a kid's life, whoever those elders might be. So like, what would you recommend to parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, that circle of older loved ones who, through their behavior and their choices, right, are really handing down an attitude about money that's going to stay with kids for their entire lives?
Yeah, when we look at studies of who people listen to, we think that the kids aren't listening to their parents, but they are. They're listening and they're watching. And so if you are not a good money manager, do everything that you can to study it, and so that you can get better and you can pass on better habits to your children. And if you're already doing that, keep doing it. Push through. You know, it was not easy for my husband and I to buck the system, to buck our peers, to train our children how to be good money managers. managers, and all three of them are fantastic money managers, and they are so cheap, and I'm just so thrilled about that. I'm so proud of the way they handle their money, and it just, you have to beg them to buy stuff now. And so, and that's why I do, because not everyone had the benefit of like your parents and my grandmother, Big Mama. They didn't have a Big Mama. And so that's what I've been trying to do with this column. I've been trying to be that Big Mama for people who didn't have that person in their life that says, you're okay if you just wear those regular t-shirts, those regular sneakers. You're okay. You don't have to have that fancy car. Mm. You are good in your skin, and be grateful for where you are. And that's the role that I've been trying to do in this column for this, 25 years for the Washington Post.
And I'm looking forward to 25, 50, 75 more years, Michelle. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming back with us today.
Oh, I appreciate it. I love being on the show, and I love this forum. And I'm just so grateful to all the readers. And I have a toll-free number if people want to ask me more questions.
We're going to put it on our website, onpointradio.org, because we got to go. Michelle Singletary, thank you so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.